This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. Living shorelines, wetland restoration, oyster reefs. Green infrastructure is an effective and proven method of increasing coastal resilience, stabilizing the shoreline, and cleaning the waters of eastern North Carolina. But can the approach be used farther upstream and brackish water, in more urban settings to restore polluted waterways? The city of Jacksonville and local scientists are trying to answer that question.
It's a very different kind of setting. There are different stressors. There's different physical structure there. But as best we can tell so far, they seem to be doing quite well in these urban areas, and that's really promising.
Today, the New River is teeming with life, but this wasn't always the case. For more than four decades, the city of Jacksonville discharged treated wastewater effluent into Wilson Bay, and in 1995, a dike collapsed at an Onslow County hog farm, sending 25 million gallons of waste surging into the New River. Jacksonville stormwater manager Pat Donovan Potts.
It made national news, and the helicopters were all flying over, and as it passed down the New River, it made very little impact because our river was in such bad shape. It was listed as one of the top worst on the eastern seaboard.
She says levels of ammonia, phosphate, and nitrates were off the charts. The fecal coliform counts were 35,000 to 70,000 per day.
You're only allowed 200 organisms per 100 mLs of water for recreational waters, and like I said, we have 35,000 to 70,000.
That's when they knew something had to be done. The city eventually ceased discharging wastewater into the New River in 1998 with the completion of a land application wastewater treatment plant. The following year, a community-based water quality improvement and habitat restoration effort began. Donovan Potts says they wanted to use natural habitat restoration practices like oyster sills and wetlands to rehabilitate the contaminated waterway.
To date, literally to date, we've put in 8.1 million oysters. And the reason why we used oysters is basically because one adult oyster, which is about the size of your hand, can filter up to 10 gallons of water every 24 hours. So if you say 10 gallons times 8.1 million, it's a lot of water turning over.
Two oyster sills run parallel to the bulkhead in front of Wilson Bay Estate Park. Six more surround Wilson Island. The city also installed three aeration units in the bay to deliver oxygen to an anaerobic bottom.
Before, we had 0 milligrams per liter of dissolved oxygen on the bottom, and now we have the required 5 milligrams per liter.
They also constructed 9 square miles of wetland and marsh habitats, which provide nutrient processing and fish nurseries. The restoration measures started to work right away, and in 2001, Donovan Potts says they saw the bottom of Wilson Bay for the first time and found their first bottom-dwelling creatures.
I had never seen a crab pot. I had never seen a gillnet or fishermen in this part of the river. And then after 2001, when we started putting out our reports, I mean, some days there's so many trout fishermen in the bay area or in the middle of I actually have to dodge boats.
Now that Wilson Bay supports a variety of aquatic life, it would seem that over the span of 17 years, the waterway has fully recovered. But a team of local researchers with the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration want quantifiable evidence of exactly how well the water quality and habitat restoration projects are working. Dr. Mike Peeler is a professor at IMS in Morehead City. He's also the head of estuarine ecology and human health at the Coastal Studies Institute.
What we were interested in was trying to make some fairly advanced measurements of nitrogen removal. Nutrients are really important in estuaries, and when you have too much nutrients, that's a problem. Salt marshes and oyster reefs, two of the things that the city of Jacksonville have been restoring, both of those habitats are known to be areas with elevated amounts of nitrogen removal.
There are two sets of data being gathered. One component of the project involves taking sediment cores and water samples from wetlands in Wilson Bay to determine if they're removing nitrogen from the water. Dr. Peeler is involved with collecting the mud samples and bringing them back to the lab.
We've set up incubations that allow us to understand the interaction between the sediment and the water, and that interface is a really important area for nutrient cycling. And so we run our incubations, and then at some point in the near future, our data will be in, and we'll have a sense of how effectively those systems, how they are cycling nutrients and whether or not they're effectively removing nutrients.
Sediment and water samples from the restored wetland will be compared to samples collected from 20 acres of natural wetlands on the other side of Wilson Bay and areas without marshes. They'll also compare current nutrient levels to those collected back in 1999. The second component of the project examines the impact sea level rise has on wetlands and Wilson Bay. Marshes grow as water levels change, but if sea levels rise too quickly,
they may or may not be able to keep up, and of course we also see a lot of erosion.
Research ecologist at NOAA's National Ocean Science Lab in Beaufort, Carolyn Curran, says work at the Wilson Bay site will allow them to track how salt marshes grow. The team of scientists recently installed 6 stainless steel rods 30 to 40 feet into the marsh and encased them in concrete.
They provide a permanent point of reference from which measures can be made to both to measure changes in both the vertical and horizontal edge of the marsh. They require really zero maintenance, and you just have a special instrument, which is you can bring out and set on top of that benchmark, which can measure very fine-scale changes in marsh surface elevation change on the orders of millimeters.
While this type of study has been conducted at the coast, there isn't much data for wetlands and brackish regions of the estuary, especially a restored area in an urban setting. Curran says it will take 4 to 5 years of data collection to get any real results. The team of researchers are planning another trip to the site in the fall to collect more sediment core samples. NOAA will routinely monitor the sediment elevation table. In the spring, the data and the results of the project will be presented at the State of the River Address, held by the New River Roundtable. The annual meeting brings together environmental groups, educators, scientists, state, local, and county government, and universities to discuss the health of the river. Jacksonville Stormwater Manager Pat Donovan Potts.
One of the things about the New River is it starts and ends in the same county. So we are cursed in that we can't point our fingers upriver and go, it's their fault. But we are so blessed in saying we can't point upriver and say, it's their fault. It's our fault, and we are the ones that need to take ownership of it and be good stewards and continue to bring her back to life.
To make sure the New River remains healthy, the researchers involved with this project want to inspire the next generation to maintain their conservation efforts. They're collaborating with the nonprofit Sturgeon City to provide educational materials for K-12 students. The center will include demonstrations on the restoration of Wilson Bay and how the city continues to support other areas in need. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The summer is a perfect time for outdoor recreation like camping and hiking or enjoying the garden in your own backyard. But watch out, snakes are lurking. This week, Mac McKee speaks with Dr. Sean Bush. He's a venom expert at ECU's Brody School of Medicine. Dr. Bush has appeared on Animal Planet, the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, and PBS, and was featured on the television show Venom ER.
There are approximately 37 species of snakes here in North Carolina, but only 6 of them are venomous. Now, we know about cottonmouths, or as more commonly known, moccasins and copperheads. But what other snakes may we come into contact here in eastern North Carolina and where?
Well, you could come in contact with a timber rattlesnake or a pygmy rattlesnake. There's also eastern diamondback, and I believe you already mentioned copperhead, cottonmouth. And did you say coral snake? Have we mentioned that yet?
No, a coral snake. Now, that's interesting because all the other snakes you seem to have mentioned are the, maybe the viperous kind with the fangs that really just like to sink into you. But do copperheads, I hear they like to chew.
Well, the vipers are the ones with the movable front fangs, very efficient delivery apparatus. Coral snakes have fixed front fangs, but they don't have any trouble penetrating your skin. It's kind of a urban legend or myth that they have trouble getting through skin. They don't have to bite in your web space of your fingers. They can bite you without attacking those spots.
Do all venomous snakes have that ability to inflict a venomous bite, or do they sometimes just give you what's called a dry bite? It might be painful, but it might not have any other dire consequences to it.
Well, dry bites can happen, but they really are the exception to the norm, and we've studied this many different ways, and it sounds like the dry bite rate is actually much less than 10%. A dry bite is just like an injection, a puncture, with absolutely no venom introduced, which means no tenderness, no swelling, nothing more than what you would receive from a tiny pinprick. And if you have any more than that, it's not a dry bite.
There was an incident in mid-July here in Newbert and Craven County where a two-year-old girl was bitten by a 4.5-foot rattlesnake twice on the leg. Were you aware of that particular case?
Right. I was part of the team. I helped out with the management of that little girl's care, and she was just a darling little girl. But she did look what it looked like, you know. And there's pictures of this, but it looked like there was two bite wounds. And snakes can bite in rapid succession and deliver equivalent amounts of venom with each bite. General rule of thumb, the more fang contact you have, the worse the bite is. You know, if it's a longer bite or a double bite, you're going to have worse snake bite severity. And this girl's snake bite severity was off the scale.
I guess she's going to make that full recovery, and probably that's how her parents responded. What did they do correctly to make sure that she was out of danger as quickly as she was?
Well, I think that, first of all, just recognizing that this is a venomous snake bite, because venomous snake bite is an emergency. It's a great reason. It kind of obligates you to call 911, and that's the proper course of action. EMS gets involved. They get ground crews on scene quickly. You know, you go to the closest hospital where anti-venom is available, and a lot of times these hospitals just stock small amounts of anti-venom because it's so expensive, and then they get transferred to a specialty center like ours where we have, you know, a lot of people that specialize in snake bite like myself, and we have toxicologists, and even our surgeons know quite a bit about management of venomous snake bite.
Dr. Bush, I've got some snake bite myths and facts here I'd like to read to you, and you tell me if they're true or false. Here's the first one. A bite from a baby venomous snake is more dangerous than one from an adult because they don't know how to control how much venom to inject.
And see, and you know that's a myth, and that's the most popular myth. If I had $1 million, I'd give you $1 million to tell me where that myth came from, because it is. Almost every lecture I give or presentation I give, people have this misconception. Now, baby rattlesnakes or baby venomous snakes in general can deliver a serious bite, but it's the larger the snake, the more venom volume introduced, and that correlates with the snake bite severity.
Now, here's something that we've all seen in many a Western movie. Tell me if this is true or false. Sucking the venom out of the wound will help to extract the poison.
Yeah, that's also not recommended. In fact, I tell people that method just sucks. You know, it doesn't get any, it doesn't remove any venom.
And here's a final one for you. Applying a tourniquet will prevent the venom from circulating around in the bloodstream.
This is a little trickier because there's certain kind of snakes that you apply a special kind of tourniquet, and it only needs to be tight enough to flow the lymphatic tract. So it's not very tight. It's like an ace wrap. And that is only recommended for coral snakes. But here we generally do not recommend tourniquets, except in the rare case of coral snake. And coral snakes bite fewer than 1-2% of the snake bites that occur each year.
So in conclusion then, your advice would be if you see a snake, look at it, don't disturb it, and don't give it a reason to attack you.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if you see it. I mean, you can appreciate it from afar. Try not to intentionally interact with it, because that's how most people get bitten.
Well, Doctor, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Absolutely, it's my pleasure.
Since the passing of a sweeping voting bill in 2013, North Carolina's electoral process has been in a state of constant flux. A panel of federal court judges wrote the latest chapter of the state's electoral saga last Friday when it decided unanimously that the law, which in part required a form of government identification to vote, was discriminatory and repealed it. The court's decision was also controversial, but at least one local election official says confusion and frustration among voters and officials is bipartisan. Chris Thomas has more.
It's easy to miss Greene County, North Carolina. Its estimated population is just over 21,000. At a relatively slight 266 square miles, it's the ninth smallest county in North Carolina.
With us being a rural county, we have a lot of population that is focused on agriculture.
That's Stephen Hines, director of the Greene County Board of Elections. He's held that position for a year, and he's from neighboring Lenoir County.
We do have some folks who used to work over at Industries in Kinston, DuPont. Population, registered voters-wise, I can tell you, is around 11,000. We're a relatively small county, but we do have somewhat of a diverse population.
Over the past 3 years, there's been tremendous changes in voter ID requirements, early voting schedules, congressional district maps, and primary elections. Mr. Hines said the cost has been nominal on the local level, but time spent training and retraining Election Day assistants has increased significantly this year.
We've already met with them one time, and we're scheduled to meet two more times with them before the general election.
And is that abnormal, or is that about what folks would expect?
That is abnormal. Normally we would only have the two-hour class prior to the general election.
That's not to mention the frustration he's fielded from voters in the county.
Regardless of the lawmakers who make the laws and the judges who interpret the laws and may change things, they're not the ones who are actually there at the polling place facing the voter. It's the poll worker. And that poll worker is going to see a lot of frustration anytime there's a change. It doesn't matter if it's showing an ID or not showing an ID. If it's a change, it's going to be some frustration from the voters.
Mr. Hines summed up the last 3 years in two words.
Ever-changing.
And as it stands now, much of that training might be for naught. Last Friday, July 29th, a three-judge panel for the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals scrapped North Carolina's entire voting law overhaul, bringing everything back to where it was on August 11th, 2013, the day before it was signed into law by Governor Pat McCrory. East Carolina University political science professor Carmine Scarvo explains the law in its original form was much more constricting.
Soon after that, in response to the threat of lawsuits, the legislature changed the ruling somewhat and said, well, if you can't produce a photo ID, you could produce one of a series of other kinds of documents to prove that you really were you.
But that did not sway the court's panel. The unanimous decision, written by longtime Fourth Circuit Judge Diana Motz, was scathing, bringing the state to task on its history of race-based discrimination at the polls, including a perceived effort to do the same with its most recent voting law. Dr. Scarvo said voting laws have to pass two tests, for intent and effect. The prior is the more stringent, and the state did not pass.
The court found that the North Carolina law intended to reduce minority voting strength. Not simply that it had the effect of doing it, that the legislature in passing the law intended to discriminate against minorities.
But that's not how LaShonda Humphrey, a black woman from New Bern, saw things. I asked her how she felt when she heard the voter ID law had been struck because it was deemed discriminatory by federal judges.
Kind of shocked. I don't see how it was, but if that's what they said.
Ms. Humphrey said she's been an active voter for the past two election cycles and was ready to show her ID at the polls come November. She said her top priority in public life is equality, and as far as she could see, the voter ID requirement did just that.
The voter ID law, it didn't affect me. Like, it didn't bother me because even in a quote-unquote rural area that we live in, you have to have an ID at some point. I don't see what the problem was showing it if it was required, as long as everybody had to show it.
Fairness is also important to Jackie Charwood of Jacksonville, also a registered voter. Ms. Charwood's belief in the democratic process is why she thinks the Fourth Circuit Court's decision was a mistake.
I don't know exactly how you're supposed to get through life without some sort of ID. You know, I mean, even to file for government assistance, you have to have an ID.
The court echoed the law's opponents when it said it disproportionately affected large portions of the population, including people who are poor. But Charwood holds on to her opinion, even after experiencing poverty herself.
I was a single parent with two children. I was on government assistance. My parents paid for my apartment, and I had a broken down, almost didn't make it from A to B car. So I definitely understand, but I still think it's extremely important to be able to show who you are and where you come from and make sure that your voice is heard.
Her biggest concern lays in the fairness of the election process. She worries the stakes are so high and upcoming races are so close that the desire to get an edge by any means may prove irresistible without stronger proofs against voter fraud.
I don't want to say that people are dishonest, but people are dishonest. if they think that they can get a one-up, a lot of people will.
But times have changed, Dr. Scarvo said, and ballot stuffing at the level seen in previous generations is almost impossible, even with same-day voter registration and without proof of ID at the polls. Voting, he says, is just different.
Selling pseudoephedrine or something across the counter, there's no idea that the pharmacist is going to discriminate against African Americans or discriminate against young people or discriminate against poor people or anything else. But we know that this history is there in voting because it happened for hundreds of years.
Furthermore, he says these laws do disproportionately impact major portions of Eastern North Carolina's electorate. The region is still, primarily, rural, and getting out to the DMV can be especially difficult if it holds strange hours. The state has 24 satellite offices for driver's licenses. They're in some of the state's smallest and poorest counties, including Washington, Currituck, Perquimans, Pamlico, Jones, Hyde, and Greene counties. These offices are only open 10 days out of the year.
The voter ID law has probably a bigger impact on Eastern North Carolina than it does on the rest of the state, because the four demographic groups that are most widely affected by this are minorities, rural people, students, and poor people. And, you know, minorities, rural people, and poor people, there's a lot of overlap in those categories.
The law's ultimate fate is unknown. Its advocates have vowed to take up the fight to the Supreme Court if necessary. Meanwhile, Stephen Hines knows he and his voters are still in limbo. The future, for the most part, is out of their hands. If you want to read excerpts from the Fourth Circuit Court's decision, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. You'll also find a link to the full text and more on what you need to know before you go to the polls in November. I'm Chris Thomas.
This is Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. The heat of summer is definitely on us, and if you've been avoiding your garden during the daylight hours, you might want to think about how your garden can shine at night. First, consider adding some plants that bloom at night. Two good choices include moonflower and angel's trumpet. Moonflower is a tropical vine related to morning glory. We grow it as an annual in our area, and it can be started from seed, but will quickly stretch 10 to 20 feet and can be covered in 6-inch wide white flowers in just 2 months. Each flower opens for only one night, but new flowers are produced each day to keep up the show. You'll want to choose a site in full or part sun, and with a sturdy trellis or fence for the moonflower vine to climb. Angel's trumpet, or Brugmansia, grows as a large shrub in our area. This is a traditional pass-along plant in many coastal southern communities. Angel's trumpet dies back to the ground at the first frost, but resprouts in late spring. By midsummer, the new shoots can be 8 to 10 feet tall or larger, and covered in pendulous flowers up to 10 to 12 inches in length. The flowers come in shades of pink, white, or yellow. The blooms start in late summer and continue well until frost. You'll want to be aware that all parts of Brugmansia are poisonous, so take that into consideration prior to planting. You'll also want to beware of the evening primrose. That's a plant that shows up on most every night flowering plant list. There are several species of evening primrose, but the prettiest one, showy evening primrose, can become a very aggressive weed. Most of us are familiar with the bees, butterflies, and flies that carry out daytime pollination services. But as the sun sets, the moths take over. One of the most interesting groups of moths that you are likely to see are the hawk or sphinx moths. These strong flyers hover like hummingbirds as they sip nectar from the flowers. They can dart quickly from side to side to avoid predators. Flowers are an obvious draw in the moonlight garden, but foliage plays an important role as well. Include plants with silver, pale blue-green, or variegated foliage. These light-colored leaves will reflect the last rays of the setting sun or the pale glow of moonlight. Look for the silver foliage of lamb's ear or artemisia, or for herbs like silver sage or thyme. Variegated varieties of canna or hostas will provide visual interest day or night. Finally, locate your moonlight garden where you're most likely to enjoy it, near a patio, deck, or other outside sitting area. Choose somewhere that you can sit and enjoy the luminous flowers, intriguing pollinators, and reflective foliage, all while avoiding the summer heat.